Open up the committee hearing. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2782.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
House Bill 2782 allows turning off non-emergency numbers for calls that are not appropriate for a 911 jurisdiction on an emergency listing page of a telephone book. The committee conducted hearing on this bill on May 6th, at which time there was a motion to an amendment adopted to add emergency clause to the bill. We have since received an amendment, which is a -A2 amendment, which you have in your in front of you. And it basically is the bill that you have done the hearing on, with a section 2 added, which says this 1999 Act being necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety, an emergency is declared to exist, and this 1999 Act takes effect on its passage.
Is there any questions? That was an agreement. Shall we move dash two amendments to 2782? Comments? Objections? Order. The chair for 2782 to the floor with a due pass amendment. Remove House Bill 2782 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Ordered. Anybody want to carry that one? That's a Portland bill. That's 911. Is that any good that I can do?
Oh,
I'm better than that. Sure. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3063. There's Jack. Can you run? Take a hand. Try and get you in and out of here quickly.
Chairman is the committee for recommending Jack Robertson, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry. This bill was actually sponsored on request by Representative Wilson, and I would like to say, I think you're being held in session at gunpoint, but this is a fairly non-controversial bill, so I hopefully can explain it to your satisfaction. First of all, background on the Wage Security Fund. The Wage Security Fund was established back in 1986. And the purpose behind it is to provide some relief for those workers who are left with unpaid wages when a business closes down, disappears overnight, or goes bankrupt. And the theory is that the state can help to provide the payment and then seek recovery, since the time pressure on us is not always as great as it is on many workers who would be left otherwise without a paycheck when that is the only thing keeping their family afloat. It's funded by a diversion which is authorized under federal law from the Unemployment Insurance Fund, and the amount of the diversion is 0.03%, 0.25% a biennium. So 0.25 out of 8, they divert 0.03% into a fund which we then manage and from which payments can be made exclusively for those workers who are left with unpaid wages when a business goes out of business or files bankruptcy. And then, as I say, we step into their shoes and we proceed to collect. This fund was originally authorized on a 2-year trial basis and then was renewed on a 3-year basis. Each legislative session to see how it worked. After 10 years, the record was exemplary, and the legislature in 1995 approved it permanently. And we have continued to manage that the fund, and it's today, thanks primarily to a strong economy, and very healthy. In the last session, during the interim, a couple of issues came up which this bill was trying to address. One thing is that it was pointed out to us that originally when we passed this legislation, the maximum amount of wages that someone could receive out of this fund was $2,000. That's because that was the maximum amount of the preference which wages received in bankruptcy. But in the bankruptcy, among the first to be paid are those with unpaid wages up to a maximum of $2,000. Since that time, the federal bankruptcy law has been changed, so the maximum is now $4,000. And so we're requesting that we increase that amount for our fund as well. The fund is imminently capable of absorbing that. Most of our claims, frankly, are even less than the 2,000 amount. But when we get more than that, we believe that we ought to be consistent with the original underlying principle and make it the amount that is owing. The other issue that came up is the one that Representative Wilson brought to our attention. And basically what the law provides is that you can receive a payment from the fund for unpaid wages accrued during the 60 days prior to the time the business went out of business, up to the maximum amount, which is currently $2,000, we went to raise before. But that 60 days means, in other words, it's the amount that you're owed for the current work period or perhaps one work period, but it's not if they haven't paid you for 6 months or a year, that we'll go back to that. By and large, that's worked well. The situation that Representative Wilson's constituent faced was a little different. This was an employee who was not being paid, who quit work and filed a claim with us, which is frankly what we encourage workers to do when they're not being paid. Because of the time that it took to take the claim, try to collect from the business then closed down, went out of business, but it was more than 60 days after this person had worked there. And so therefore, under the strict reading of this statute, this person would be entitled to nothing, even though they had a pending wage claim with us that was still active in the 60-day period. What this amendment would do is to say that if the claimant filed a wage claim before the cessation of business, and that amount that they're claiming was remained unpaid during the 60 days before the time the business terminated, that that person could also receive a claim. We believe this happens very rarely. And again, it's something the fund can easily manage. What we thought, in fairness, the people who are doing what we are encouraging them to do, that is, they're coming to us and asking that they receive their payment, and just because the person goes out of business or goes bankrupt, their claim should not either be resolved or go back the line. And so these two changes, which I think you can see in the chairs I provided to you, would not have a significant impact on the fund, would, we believe, be consistent with the purpose of the fund. It would help provide further protections for Oregon workers, and therefore, we would hope that you would approve it.
Any questions? That's a rare question.
Mr. Chairman of Fletcher, Oregon, AFL-CIO. Jack mentioned that it was implemented in 1986. It was a joint labor management project for the 1985 session that created this fund, and it's been eminently successful since then, and inflation has outrun itself. We're just trying to catch up. Maybe I better stop while
I'm catching up. I'm sorry, suppose. Yeah, we do understand that. Any further questions? So there's on the fiscal analysis in the last thing they're talking about is 4,000 acres is consistent with the federal law. Is that refer back to the federal bankruptcy law? Okay. That's the question. Okay. Any further questions? Thank you. Close public hearing, open up a work session on House Bill 3063.
Move to the floor and do pass recommendation.
Senator Miller moves House Bill 3063 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Must be fine. Any comments?
Yeah.
Correction. Sorry, anybody want to carry this good bill? Okay. Senator Blyer. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3151, modifying membership criteria for state credit unions. Senator Metzger. And who else is?
All right.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make my comments brief because my
learned friends from the Canadian community can give more specific details. For the record, my name is Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14, and I'm pleased to be here to offer testimony in support of House Bill 3151. House Bill 3151 really is the reason I am here in the Oregon State Senate. It is a this version of what was SB 391 in the 1997 session, and I think we all remember the contentious field of membership bill that was before the legislature in 1997. What 3151 is a result of today is what can happen when people work collectively and cooperatively to solve problems. The Canadian community, as you know, supports a lot of good in our community. We have over 1 million Canadian members in the state of Oregon alone. But there were contentious issues in trying to define proper field of membership. On a federal level, this was taken care of. Through the help of Speaker Newt Gingrich in the House, a majority leader Clint Lott in the Senate, at the federal level, in Congress, the Congress, by votes of 92 to 6 and 411 to 8, passed the Federal Credit Union Act. That affects federally chartered credit unions. This bill, HB 3151, assures essentially those same parameters to state chartered credit unions here in the state of Oregon so that we're all operating on the dual membership charter that has long been a mantra of the credit union movement. A couple of things just to point out, and everyone else will point out the other details. One thing that 3151 does is clearly define community charters, those areas, particularly in rural communities, in which you need to have a community charter in order to serve members of the credit union community. On a federal level, for example, an example would be the Grant Baker Federal Credit Union, in which, by a geographic pie, those folks are served by a credit union. On a state level, 3151 will also help define those parameters. It's an excellent bill. Credit unions serve Oregonians so very well. And it's a pleasure to finally close this loop after a couple of years, and with the help of the Oregon Bankers Association and working with the Oregon Credit Union League, this bill passed 16-0 in the House of Representatives, and there'll be people here to speak on it, and I appreciate the ability to put my comments on the record as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. We got Pam and Hal and Dan. And this is where the group hug. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Pamela Levitt with the Oregon Credit Union League, and here today with me is Hal Scoggins, our retained counsel for the Oregon Credit Union League, and Dan Pan, who is the CEO of NAPS Credit Union here in Salem. We have submitted formal testimony to you. We will not read that. This is a bill that has been a long time in the making. As Senator Metzger stated, we've worked very hard on this bill over the last 4 years, and we are thankful that Congress agreed to pass similar legislation at the federal level, and we are asking now for our state charter credit unions to have similar authority. And Mr. Scoggins will briefly go over the bill.
Again, the operative word being briefly, I guess. I would simply say that the current state of the Oregon Credit Union Act is...
Who's in addition to
I am. Carlton. My name is Hal Scoggins, and I am with Farley Water and Witt. We are the outside counsel for the Oregon Credit Union League. And the current state of the Oregon Credit Union Act is that it was really not very comprehensive and relies heavily on the regulator's ability to tie into the Federal Credit Union Act in order to provide the field of membership that Oregon credit unions need to serve Oregon. This bill changes that. It resolves those issues and permits Oregon state chartered credit unions to stand on their own, to be organized as occupational chartered credit unions or associational chartered credit unions, such as union credit unions, and also as community chartered credit unions, so that Oregon state chartered credit unions have a variety of means of setting themselves up to best serve the constituencies that they are organized to serve. It is very similar to, it makes the Oregon Credit Union Act very similar to the Federal Credit Union Act, but we also believe that there are some substantial improvements. Those improvements, especially in the area of community chartered credit unions, are designed to avoid the contentious issues that are ongoing at the federal level and allow Oregon credit unions and Oregon banks to do what they do best, and that's to serve Oregonians with financial services and not to focus on protecting the church.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dan Penn. I'm president and CEO of Marion and Polk Schools Credit Union, or MAPS Credit Union here in Salem. And I do appreciate the opportunity to comment on 3151. I'm here today not just representing MAPS Credit Union alone, but I'm representing all of the state chartered credit unions in Oregon. And I do want to say that on behalf of all of the credit unions, we do certainly support and strongly encourage passage of 3151. And MAPS Credit Union has been serving members in Marion and Polk counties for over 62 years. We have better than 30,000 members who have helped boost our asset value up to $155 million. We've been very successful, and I certainly do owe that to the support of our membership. This, however, isn't to say that we haven't had difficulties getting to that level. Just prior to 1996, we were forced to restrict membership development because of the injunction. This injunction restricted our ability to expand in small employer groups and more particularly associations. About that same time, MAPS had completed the opening of a branch in Kaiser, and the success of that branch was more specifically based on association development because our membership base at that time wasn't strong enough in Kaiser to support the branch by itself. When the injunction occurred restricting the development, the success of that branch was put in jeopardy, literally, because we had contributed a substantial amount of money into the development of that branch. The main facility had, since that time, had subsidized that branch for a much longer period of time than we had anticipated. However, since the lifting of the injunction, you know, that branch has actually done quite well. In fact, if HB 3151 were a law at the time, it was very unlikely that we would have experienced the inequities that we experienced during that time frame. And this is only one issue of a number of credit unions that they have experienced during that same time frame. The dual chartering system that has allowed the states to be laboratories or given the opportunity to be innovators of providing financial services has been a great advantage to credit unions. And we see this as an opportunity not only with relation to credit unions in Oregon but throughout the country. It would certainly well serve the banking community because of the dual chartering system and the success of it. The consumers have prospered very well in that front also. So in closing, I would encourage again, I support HB 3151, and I thank you for the opportunity and certainly welcome for questions, sir.
Thank you. Any questions? Public hearing on House Bill 3151 on open up work session on House Bill 3151. The chair would move House Bill 3151 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Chair, yes. Even though this is a class group, I still want to declare a potential conflict of interest just because of my visibility on the issue.
Okay. Any objections to the motion? Consent ordered, and Senator Metzger, I think you might want to try.
You're ordered to do that.
We have a public hearing on House Bill 2742, savings and loans, savings and funding to pay withdrawal. Just sit down. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This Dave Barrows, President, Oregon League of Financial Institutions, which is a fancy name for the savings loan. If I may, just as an aside, Mr. Chairman, say I share Senator Metzger's relief that this this previous bill is gone. Those days are over. This is a well worked out bill between all the related parties, and we thank Ms. Levitt and the whole credit union gang for working so well together, and I think it produced a good product.
Committee thanks you also.
Yeah.
I didn't want to try the case. On 2742, this is maybe the simplest bill, one of the simplest bills you'll face this session. Current Oregon law permits commercial banks, credit unions, and savings and loans to pay to the survivors of a deceased account holder some money from the deceased account holder's account if the surviving spouse, or if there is no surviving spouse, the children of majority age come in with an affidavit. And that's what the law provides today. In the case of the commercial banks and the credit unions, the amount that they can pay is up to $25,000, cumulative in all institutions. In the savings loan case, it's $15,000. And this bill merely makes it the same figure of $25,000, and we appreciate your support. Ask the House of how to send any vote.
Thank you.
Any questions? Let's have a hearing on House Bill 2742. Open up work session on House Bill 2742. The chair moves House Bill 2742 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. Senator Starr, you want to carry that one?
Can do that.
All right, thank you. Man, this is moving right along. Open up public hearing on House Bill 2402, Advancing Corporate Farms from Occupational Safety and Health. And health, who is that? Who are the witnesses? Not here. No. Okay, so what's your representatives? Come on up, yeah. Well, welcome, gentlemen. Is this a group hug, or are we in?
Yes, sir. Okay. For the record, my name is David Sparks. I'm the Deputy Administrator for Oregon OSHA. And this bill actually is a bill that was introduced by the Farm Bureau Federation at the request of Representative Jeff Cruz. And hadn't intended to offer a testimony, but I'd be here to ask answer questions if there were any. Ivan, do you want to go ahead and introduce?
Okay, for the record, my name is Ivan Wells, and I'm a wine grape grower from Buena Vista. And I'm the chair, legislative chair of the Oregon Wine Growers. And we also favor this bill.
Okay. And just what I exempt, just take off the question, Senator Starr?
I wanted to ask a question.
Sure.
And I think you were fixing to answer it maybe, but my understanding of the bill is what it's driving toward is those family farms that are incorporated but still operated by a family unit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, that's exactly correct. The currently Oregon OSHA has a policy not to apply our safety and health standards to small core family farms that have elected not to cover themselves with workers' compensation insurance. And the bill in the engrossed form today is different than it was when it was initially introduced on the House side. But having worked with Mr. Schellenberg and other folks with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, came up with the language you had before you. And what it would do then is for those core family farms that elect to incorporate would be exempt from coverage for 654, the Oregon Safe Employment Act. Same individuals, same folks, just one day they're not incorporated and the next day they would be.
Mm-hmm. Is the individual family farm, it's not really statutes, you just don't follow those OSHA rules, or there a certain amount of employees you have to have? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we had several years ago made a policy decision where the small family farms are not exempt by statute or by rule, but we did it via policy. Now, if a small farm elects to purchase a workers' compensation insurance policy to cover itself, then we would assume some jurisdiction over that from a health and safety standpoint.
Okay. Any questions? Tim, I don't think you need to testify unless you want to. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2402. Open up a work session on House Bill 2402. And the chair would move House Bill 2402 be engrossed to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. Senator Starr, Chair. And I suppose perhaps I should prefer Tempest Fund because I'm not a corporation, but those possibilities. So, done that one. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2486. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Another group hug bill?
Yeah, you bet.
Well, just send all those things over from the house. Thank you. We've got all the problems. Welcome to the Inclusion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. You probably heard by now that AOI represents over 19,000 businesses statewide, and our members employ over 30% of Oregon's private workforce. Before I start on what House Bill 2486 actually does, let me give you a little bit of background, and I know you'll hear more about this background from some of the people who are testifying after me. In 1995, AOI proposed some changes to Oregon's what was then part of a patchwork of family and parental and pregnancy leave laws. Prior to 95, we've been putting these laws into place kind of in a piecemeal fashion. None of them covered employers with the same amount of employees, and they had a lot of different provisions that made the whole system inconsistent and very difficult for employers to apply. If you've been around for a while, if you've dealt with employees in the past, you may remember the Bureau of Labor and Industries at one time had a chart that was about this big that showed what kind of leave to what kind of employee and when it applied, when what kind of leave you were trying to take applied. That was in the days before Jack Roberts. And although the people at Boley were pretty proud of that chart, I would say that if you need a chart that big, you probably have a problem with the laws that you're trying to apply. So we introduced a bill in 95 that would take all those laws and put them into one law, make them a little bit more consistent and easier for people to figure out. And as we work through negotiations with interested parties that include several of the people you'll hear from today, obviously there were things that we had to give up, things that we got, sort of the normal course of negotiations and what was kind of a hotly contested bill for a while. We did manage to put together a bill that was a very good piece of legislation and passed with flying colors, but there were some things that we had to give up in order to get that bill that we were very concerned about. So in 1997, we came back, as AOI came back, with a package of sort of what we thought were housekeeping, and some other people disagreed, changes to fix the issues that we were still concerned about in the law. Thanks to some of my friends, who you'll hear from soon, that bill went absolutely nowhere. So we regrouped and decided not to pursue any of those issues, frankly, until we started hearing from our members about the one issue that's presented to you in House Bill 2486. Frankly, I didn't want to come back and deal with family leave legislation again this time, but we heard from so many people who had so many problems over and over that we couldn't avoid it, unfortunately. So the fix for that is encompassed in House Bill 2486. And basically the problem that we have is that right now Oregon's family leave law is the only law in the country that requires employers to return employees to the exact same position that they left when they come back from family leave. As you probably know, Oregon businesses of 50 or more are required by federal law to pay the same wage, and also by the Oregon family leave law, so that would cover 25 or more, to pay the same wage to a returning employee. But only Oregon businesses are overly burdened by having to return employees to the exact same position that they left. So we've had cases and heard from members who have employees that are arguing that the exact same position means the exact same desk, the exact same bus route if they're a bus driver, the exact same building, that kind of thing. So it's kind of an extreme situation that's causing some serious problems for our members. One that I can relate to you in particular is that a retail member of AOI had a handbag buyer, I think it was a handbag buyer, that left on family leave, and when she came back, she was offered another buyer's position. It might have been women's tailored clothing or something like that, but it was equivalent seniority, equivalent pay, benefits, job duties, that kind of thing, and she was able to insist, because of Oregon's current law, that she be returned to the handbag buyer's position. Now, when you get into a higher-level position, you probably know a buyer is kind of a high-level position in a retail establishment. You can't just bring in a temporary when somebody leaves on family leave. You have to bring in somebody and train them in order to take over that position, probably spend some time with them, and work, you know, invest quite a bit in that person's career and ability to do the job that they're covering for. And it's difficult to fire them or remove them from the position that they've taken over when somebody comes back from family leave and wants their old job back, especially if there's an equivalent position available. So what our members have been doing because of the law is if there's an equivalent position available, they put the person that they trained for the one job into the equivalent position to return the person coming back to the job that they're in. But I guess what we're asking for is a little bit more flexibility and employers being able to decide these workforce issues without the opportunity to do anything to harm the employee. So House Bill 2486 defines an equivalent position as having equivalent pay, equivalent job benefits, equivalent shift. That's something that we added in the House as a concern because I believe it was the Nurses Association came to us and said, what if somebody's been working their whole life to get off the night shift and get on the day and they go on family leave? I mean, is the night shift equivalent? And obviously that wouldn't be satisfactory for anybody. So we did include an equivalent position, same or equivalent shift, which would mean, you know, within just a couple hours of the shift that the person had been in before they left. So I think that gives you a good idea of what's in the bill. We try to make it as narrow as we can in order to protect the employee and still provide a little bit more flexibility to employers. You'll probably hear from Bowie that they haven't heard a lot of complaints about this law, or at least we heard on the House side that they hadn't. But I would submit to you that most businesses are going to be more likely to talk to a business association like AOI about problems they're having with this law than they would be to talk to the regulatory agency that's charged with enforcing this law towards them. So I don't know if it's reasonable to say that there's not a problem because Foley hasn't heard about it much. The other thing I would say to you is that there's been a lot of talk that the law that was crafted in 1995 was carefully balanced, carefully negotiated, and is something that we shouldn't disturb because it's a delicate balance, and if you mess with one part of it, the whole thing becomes unfair or unbalanced. What I would say to that is that we got as close as we could in 95 to a good balance. And we really haven't had any problems with the law, and we thought that it worked very well, except for this one particular problem. So I would submit to you that if we're having as many complaints and concerns from AOI members and businesses who are not AOI members, probably we don't have quite as good of a balance as we thought we did. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would urge your support of House Bill 2486.
Do you have any documentation of the complaints?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, unfortunately, most of the members that we've talked to don't want to have their name out there. I could probably, well, we will have some letters coming to you from people that have had the actual problem. But there are quite a few people that don't want to talk about it, and I have to tell you that some of those people were breaking the law unintentionally by putting people back in equivalent positions until we told them that, you know, you can't do that.
I suppose they can do it voluntarily.
They can do it voluntarily, yes, but it's still not technically legal.
First of all, I appreciate your honesty about not wanting to deal with the issue. I think there's a lot of people in the Senate that don't want to deal with the issue either, but we are. And I would follow up on Senator Beyer's question about, you know, the volume of complaints. There's trying to get an idea of the magnitude of the issue. I can understand maybe why someone may not want to talk specifically about their situation, but I would think that you would have some statistical data from things that would be presented to AOI in terms of just how serious a problem this was.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, we don't actually keep statistical data of that kind. I would say we've probably had 20 or 30 calls in the last 2 years, which, as far as complaints to AOI go, is a pretty huge number.
Mm-hmm.
We usually get like one.
You mentioned, too, that Bowie had testified in the House side that they didn't get a lot of complaints there, but that would not necessarily be unusual. Why don't you think people would complain to the Bureau of Labor Industry?
I think probably because they're the enforcing agency, and if that employer is making a mistake or doing something wrong, they don't want necessarily to be talking to the person that's enforcing the law against them.
Okay. If that's the case, then it sounds like there's some, you know, fear or intimidation that different people would. It sounds like what you're saying, they'd be afraid a little bit of doing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, what I would say is not necessarily that they're afraid of Foley. We've had a really good experience with Foley on the whole, as an association and with our members.
what I would say to you is that that's not their first choice.
Okay. Well, I guess I wasn't meaning they'd be afraid of bullying, but afraid of maybe exposing themselves to their employer or have some problems there.
Exposing themselves.
Well, I mean, if they were to complain to bully, I mean,
I think there have been, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I think there have probably been employee complaints to bully, but their employers are not going to tell bully first that they have a problem in an area like this. They would talk to us because we can, you know, do what we can to help them.
You mentioned equivalent shifts, for example. You mentioned nursing, which is interesting. My wife's a nurse. If you, you said within a few hours would be an equivalent shift. Who makes that determination of whether, I mean, in your eyes, it's, you know, if you work 8 to 5 or someone else gives you noon to 8, that may or may not be equivalent depending on what your intention was. How would that be determined?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, my intention is for it to be the same shift. I think if it's shifted, if it's switched by like an hour or something real minimal like that, that would be acceptable. But we generally intend for it to be the same hour. I know that families organize their schedules around shifts like that, and that's not something we want to get into.
Okay, so you mentioned that under this, an example would be an equivalent position might be in a branch. If you're working with U.S. Bank, for example, on 39th and Sandy, you might get assigned to the downtown branch. Would that be then considered an equivalent position?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, it's within 20 miles.
Okay, well, that would certainly be within 20 miles. Just as an example here, if someone was living, and let's use that example if I might, let's say in the Hollywood District of Portland, because it's a U.S. branch there, and there was a possibility they might be sent out to the Beaverton branch, which is within 20 miles of that area, but significant long commute over the Sunset Highway, and thought that that might happen to them, would you think that might be a detriment for them using family leave, which is the intent of actually helping to support families, because of the fact they would be afraid that the U.S. Bank would assign them somewhere which away from their normal life pattern?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I think that if you are faced with a situation like that, you're probably going to have to weigh all the elements, and I can't speak for any particular employee's decision about whether that would be an overriding element. I will tell you that the reason we put the 20-mile limit in here is because that's what's in federal law, and we're trying to get as close as we can to being equivalent to federal law because it's easier for employers to figure out what they have to do in this state as opposed to any other state they may be in.
But then, I think I hear what you're saying, that for some people that might be an element that would be discouraging to them.
It may be.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Betsy.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Lynn, pardon me, but pardon me, Trisha Smith and Larry Lumen. Hey, Jim Garrett, excuse me. Now we can all kind of come up and get close here. Okay. Okay, then Lynn, Trisha, and Jim. I didn't see Jim's name. I'm sorry. Welcome. Please introduce yourself. Proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Parton. I'm here on behalf of the Women's Rights Coalition in opposition to House Bill 2486. We appreciate having the opportunity to speak today on this important topic. For your information, the Women's Rights Coalition is a statewide private nonprofit organization consisting of a number of other statewide private nonprofit organizations, including the League of Women Voters, the Oregon American Association of University Women, the Oregon Student Association, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, YWCA, and others. This is our 25th anniversary of supporting women's social equality and security, including economic security. And we are opposing House Bill 2486 as being an unnecessary and unwarranted incursion on current family leave laws, which we believe are working well. Before addressing the merits of the bill, I would like to make a couple comments on the procedural aspect of how this bill is coming to you. You are, in essence, seeing this bill for the first time today. It is this bill in this format has not been heard before. The House Business and Consumer Affairs did have multiple hearings on previous versions of this bill and sent an A&G Gross bill to the House floor. The House did not vote on that bill, but sent it back to committee. It was substantially revamped, so much so that we would submit to you that it is a completely different bill from the bill that was originally testified on. And it nonetheless received not a public hearing, but only a work session. I bring this up to make the point that you should view this bill in the light of it's not being a product of public input. so you're seeing something new that has really not been discussed in specific detail before. I'd also like to note, in this connection, that the Willamette Week came out about a month ago with the top five worst bills out of the thousands circulating in the system, and this bill was one of them. And one of their comments on that was they gave it the very worst score possible for politics at its worst. In terms of the bill itself, we would like to note that one of the most difficult dilemmas facing women today is the way that they're whipsawed about their proper role in family and work life. For everybody who thinks that a woman should go out, stop flacking around at home with the kids and get a job and support herself and her family, there's somebody else who thinks that they should stay at home with the children where they belong and not work outside the home. And, of course, in many cases, this is simply not financially possible for them. This bill, unfortunately, punishes the most precisely the people who are trying to fulfill both roles responsibly, both as workers and as family care providers, by threatening with the loss of jobs if they try to take care of a male parent or spouse or a new baby. The de-engrossed version of this bill provides this threat by giving the employer, in essence, a dealer's choice to restore an employee returning from family leave to her previous position, quote unquote, in subsection 1, or to an equivalent position. And this is an open-ended, new, unequivocal option for the employer that strips away the current assurance that a returning worker has that she will get her old job back if it's still open. There's no such guarantee, even if it has remained open throughout the leave. This can certainly be expected to have a chilling effect on people's willingness to take family leave, even when desperately needed. Multiple national studies, and I'd be happy to provide you with copies of these if you're interested, have demonstrated that because family leave is unpaid, very few people take it, and those who do typically do not take it for the full period allotted by law, allowed by law. The costs to employers thus tend to be low, while the benefits of worker morale and retention tend to be high. You're going to be hearing from other people who are involved specifically in the debates and the negotiations and the compromise reached in 1995 that produced our current family leave law, and to take a unilateral run at just part of that balance now seems ill-advised. I would think that you are not hearing specific numbers about quantifying how many problems there are, what the specifics are. You keep hearing the same story that was told in 1995 about the buyer. I would submit to you that House Bill 2486 is a solution in search of a problem. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. One of the problems with this bill is that some of the people who preach most loudly about family values tend to make it the most difficult for other people to actually practice them, and I would ask you not to fall into this trap and to kill this bill. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Well, I understand the emotion on the issue and the your comments were primarily, I think, directed out of the, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But to the issue of what an equivalent position is, and that you have some comments on the jeopardy of actually what you perceive the problems with that are.
Well, what it does is it takes a presumption that currently exists that somebody will get their job back if it still exists. Somebody could leave a job, come back, nobody has filled it in that whole time. The paper is just stacking up, or whatever they do has been just sitting there. Nobody's come in, and it's still totally up to the employer whether that person is going to get that job back or just an equivalent position. And there are a lot of different situations. I think you're going to hear from Roy Wimmer later talking about, for instance, people on commission. If you're trying, you may get the same base rate of pay, but if you're going to have to go to a totally different portfolio and essentially start over again, you're going to be totally, totally behind the eight ball. And those are the kinds of things that have a very chilling effect on people willing to stick their neck out, even when they may really need to be there for a dying loved one or something like that.
Other questions?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Smith. I'm the Government Relations Specialist for Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA is a labor organization representing 16,000 classified employees working in Oregon schools, community colleges, ESDs, and park and recreation districts. Our members are the educational assistants, school bus drivers, cooks, custodians, technical staff, secretaries, and other non-certified staff who provide essential educational and operational support services in our schools across the state. With me today is one of those people I just spoke of, Jim Garrett, who is a custodian at David Douglas High School, and will be speaking to you when I'm finished about his own experience with family leave law. OSEA members strongly oppose the changes proposed by Oregon, proposed to the family leave law contained in House Bill 2486. This bill would eliminate the right of Oregon workers to return to their own job after taking unpaid leave to care for a sick or injured child or parent, a new baby, or to recover themselves from illness or injury. As you may recall, many workers in Oregon do not have the benefit of sick leave and rely on family leave in order to get well when they are sick and still have their job back. While this change doesn't prevent workers from taking family leave, it will allow an employer to suggest to an employee requesting leave that if the leave is taken, they will lose their own job and be assigned somewhere else upon return. For many workers who have striven to achieve the job in which they are currently working, this suggestion could have a very chilling effect on their decision to take the leave at all. In short, workers would be forced to choose between their responsibility to their families or their responsibility and need to retain the job that they have. Senator Byer, you indicated, or you asked a question of equivalent positions. I'd like to offer myself as an example of equivalent, what an equivalent would be for me if I were in this situation. In the union that I work for, my job is the same, is equivalent to a field representative job, which bargains and maintains contracts in school districts. Were I to take leave if House Bill 2486 were passed, and if I requested leave, my employer under this bill could say, gee, Tricia, I'm very sorry to hear about your sick child. Of course, you have the right to leave and take care of your child, but your job is very important, and we're going to have to fill it while you're gone, and we'll just put you someplace else when you get back. I'm not qualified, nor do I wish to become qualified to be a field representative for my organization. I do what I do, and that is what I am best suited for. And my employer should tell me that I would lose this job and be forced to an equivalent position within my organization for taking this leave. I would have to reevaluate the circumstances of the leave and make a decision based upon what I absolutely must do, depending upon why I'm taking the leave in the first place. And that may be to stay in my job, because over the long term, the job is very important. It's long been recognized in Oregon that the health of our society depends in large part on strong families whose members understand and take seriously their responsibility to take care of each other. At a time when so much of our attention and resources are being placed today on the serious problems that the breakdown of our families have caused, this bill flies in the face of that understanding of the need for strong families. It makes absolutely no sense to put working people in the position of either having to abandon their families in time of need or abandon the job that they may have worked years to acquire. In addition to the desperate need in our society today to strengthen rather than weaken families, we also know how important it is to business and our economy when workers have a strong sense of responsibility and loyalty to their jobs and their employers. Oregon's family leave law, as it is currently written, allows employers and workers to fulfill their responsibilities and allows workers to fulfill their responsibilities to their work at the same time they fulfill their responsibilities to their family. No real evidence has been presented to indicate that Oregon's family leave law has hurt employers. In fact, studies have shown the opposite is true. With employers experiencing lower turnover rates, higher employee morale and productivity, and the associated cost savings with those facts. In fact, many employers have long recognized how important this is, and even before there was a family leave law, allowed their employees to go home and take care of their families in a time of crisis and come back to their jobs. Some employers, however, and that's why we write laws, it's never for the majority, only for the minority, will use the changes in House Bill 2486 to put pressure on employees to stay in the job, rather than caring for their family in a time of need. Encouraging parents to take responsibility for their family is a bipartisan principle. House Bill 2486 flies in the face of this principle and does so at a time when our state is in desperate need because we are all suffering, when there is not enough being done to assure that families are the strong, healthy center of our society. Eliminating job protection rights for workers in the Family Leave Act is a betrayal to workers in Oregon who struggle every day to do the best they can for their jobs and for their families. And classified employees urge you to reject this unnecessary and detrimental proposal. And with that, I will turn the microphone over to Mr. Garrett.
You're pleased to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jim Garrett. I'm a custodian at David Douglas. And I just wanted to let you know about my situation. About 5 years ago, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. She went through the chemo, radiation, the whole thing. And she finally got to a point where she was worn out from treatment. And we were with her in the office when she went to the doctor for the last time. And the doctor told her, well, I'm going to schedule you for more treatment. She said, don't bother. I don't want any more treatment. At that time, we all could see that that was her final decision, and we respected her wishes to go ahead that way, but it also made it very difficult for us. We called the kids home that were in service on active duty and told them that we thought that if they wanted to see Grandma for the last time, they had better make some arrangements. So my mom was just as good as she could be under the circumstances for a time. We'd play cards and she'd go take a nap, and each day she'd get weaker and could play with us less time, and she'd sleep longer, and finally came down to where she just slept all the time. And of course the hospice nurse came and she assured us that it would take some time for mother to expire, and then one day she said yes, in fact mother had expired, and it would take a couple of days for her body to let go. And I used all of my vacation time, all my sick leave, and my employer had family medical leave, and they granted it to me to take care of funeral arrangements and the necessary procedure to have a body cremated. And in essence, what it boils down to is I did not have to worry about what I was going to do when I got back, if I would have the same job, if in fact I would have a job. And when it was over and everything was settled, I came back to my job, and quite frankly, I feel like it has made me a much more loyal employee, and it's given me a better attitude about the workplace. And I just am tremendously appreciative for the fact that a provision had been made for a family medical leave.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Lloyd Winner and Steve Harmon.
Good afternoon, committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer, Oregon Education Association. You have my written testimony. I won't recite it to you. It was my pleasure to serve as sort of the de facto point person on the Pro-Family Coalition that worked with all sorts of folks in 1995 to develop the compromise legislation that this bill seeks to roll back a piece of. We worked with then Senate President Gordon Smith, the Labor Commissioner, the Governor's Office, members of the business community, religious and civil rights leaders, women's groups and unions to enact a bill that, as you've heard from previous testimony, attempted to preserve the essence and the most important aspects of the family leave right while conforming and making more simple the administration of that law. Now, you've also heard that there were give and take. The pro-family side of the equation also had a lot of giveaways. We gave a lot of things away that we've had under current law, under existing law at the time, in order to preserve the job reinstatement right, which is so essential. We believe that without it, without being able to return to your own job, that the family leave law becomes, in effect, a paper tiger. And then it's a barrier to taking leave when a family needs you most. Examples of those kinds of giveaways that we bargained. In the old days, if you had pregnancy disability leave for folks with problem pregnancies, you had the opportunity not only to take leave, but also light duty. And for a lot of folks who could not afford unpaid leave, nor could they afford to personally carry health insurance, which they would also not get if they weren't able to be in the workplace. And during a problem pregnancy, I would submit that's the most essential benefit. You could take light duty if it were available at the workplace. We gave that up in the roll-up. We also gave up the time period to qualify. We had to extend that. We doubled it for most kinds of leave. That is to say that folks who were able to take certain sorts of family leaves after 90 days now had to wait 6 months to qualify if they were new employees on the job. It was a fair trade because this other right was so much more important. And I want to emphasize that because to me, it's a matter not only of bad public policy to erect barriers to leave-taking for family crises, but it's also bad faith because we had a deal and because workers get nothing back if this bill is enacted into law. It's a one-sided unilateral change. And we think that basic fairness is at stake as well as the logistics of that delicate balance of working families' needs being met. The uncertainty aspect of the bill is the second point I would make. Because equivalent is a matter of debate with respect to what that really means, an equivalent position, we don't believe that this bill is going to clarify anything or simplify anything. I can imagine there's going to be a lot of litigation, and it might be, I think on the House side, one legislator referred to it as a Full Employment Act for lawyers. The uncertainty of the bill would certainly do one thing, though, and it would be to discourage people from taking leave. Family leave, I will argue, is very popular in Oregon. Furthermore, it is very rarely used, primarily because it's unpaid for most workers, but also because I think in good faith most workers take it when in fact they need it, and let's hope most families aren't in crisis all the time, certainly not half a year, as some of our views. Finally, we've been told that most people do this anyway. It ought to be negotiated between employer and employee. Well, the same certainly could be said for negotiating the job reinstatement piece if that is so difficult, if we don't need the state to intervene in the workplace issues, then we wouldn't need this law either. I would argue one-on-one negotiation ought to work both ways. But what one man calls flexible, another refers to as an opportunity for abuse. And I'm here to say that in some cases, there are bad actors out there, folks who maybe believe that the bottom line supersedes compassion. And it's not always the case that our laws are never passed in this building for the good guys. They're generally to level the playing field so that the good guys don't get punished for their compassion, to make them more competitive for their goodwill. And if you don't believe there are bad actors out there, I would beg to differ. I have with me on my left Officer Steve Harmon with the Portland Police Department. He's here to tell a story of his family and why this law is so necessary. I've also attached to my testimony a letter that was printed in April from a labor lawyer in the Oregonian letter section an expert. I'm not an attorney, but an expert who is a labor lawyer has weighed in on this and has called the word equivalent a new murky standard. And that goes back to my point about the litigation possibilities. On the House floor, one final point was made, and this was new. It hadn't come up in the committee hearings, and I thought it deserved to be addressed here. The argument was made that we need to consider fairness to the temporary worker who fills in for the permanent employee on family leave. To me, that's a sort of a logical absurdity, because a temporary worker is by definition someone who fills in understanding in advance that it is a temporary job, and to bump a permanent worker and move them over into another job in order to retain the temp in the permanent person's position, I don't see how that is a standard of fairness that anybody with a straight face could support. Finally, as you were promised, I was going to mention the things about the word equivalent that appears to us to be problematic with respect to abuse of this new language where it's passed into law. Equivalent may not mean the same portfolio you've had. I have a friend who sells trust accounts for U.S. banks, and he worked for years to build from literally nothing, from zero to a living wage. If he were to take family medical leave under this revision, he could theoretically be given that exact same job and told to start over. The new guy's got your portfolio, you start over. His income would take a free fall. What about the low-wage worker who works on the east side of Portland where the parking is free and then gets transferred to that bank downtown where you have to pay $100, $150 a month in parking? That could be a devastating economic reality for somebody. Again, that's an equivalent position, perfectly legal under this bill. What about someone who is a reporter who has worked very hard to get a prime beat, a beat reporter assignment? That person could be reassigned to writing obits or marriage announcements. And frankly, you know, a lot of times it's not economics, it's the satisfaction of the job you do that motivates you to get out of bed in the morning and go to work. And I think that we, again, have to look at how this bill addresses those kinds of elements of a worker's job. They're simply not acknowledged in the language of equivalent. In any case, because the bill fails to acknowledge some of these kinds of scenarios, I would maintain that for those few folks who might be, for lack of a better term, described as bad actors, this flexibility that would be granted is an opportunity to offer an employee, clear and simple. And so we would certainly oppose it. Now, without saying anything more, let me turn the mic over to Officer Herman.
Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. Pardon me. Chairman and committee members, my name is Steve Harmon. As Lois said, I'm a police officer in the city of Portland. But more importantly, I'm a father of a family of four and a citizen of the state of Oregon. My wife, Bobby Harmon, had planned to testify before the committee today that she had some obligations with our daughter and couldn't attend, so I'm here to read her testimony. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Family Leave Act. As I understand it, the act is designed to protect an employee's job in the unfortunate event of a family tragedy. Currently, the law only protects people working for companies with at least 25 employees. Oregon is a state with many small businesses employing less than 25 people. Employees of these small companies also need protection. I believe the act should be strengthened to protect employees of small companies. At the very least, I urge you not to weaken the current law. I'd like to share with you my family's story. Last November 11th, my daughter attempted suicide. I received a call at work from my husband, Steve Harmon. At the time, I was employed by MedAid, DBA, G-Medical, our medical supply company. I was a salary plus commission salesperson covered a territory running from Wilsonville and Tiger to McMinnville. Prior to this incident, I normally finished in the top two in sales for the month. My daughter was in Providence Hospital for several days after the attempt. She was later admitted to the adolescent psychiatric ward for about 2 weeks. During this time, I had to take a few days off from work to be with her. I was still able to work enough to keep up my sales numbers. After my daughter was discharged from Providence, we enrolled her in a drug and alcohol treatment program. After a short period, about 10 days, the doctors admitted her to a Manual Caremark adolescent psychiatric unit. A few days later, she was discharged from my custody to continue in an outpatient drug and alcohol treatment program. because our health insurance had limited mental health care coverage. We started to incur substantial medical bills. I had to take several days off during the time to deal with my daughter. On December 16, 1998, my daughter again attempted suicide by jumping from a 9-story building. Miraculously, she ran in the tree and survived the fall. She did, however, sustain very serious injuries. Initially, my daughter was in OHSU intensive care. Later, she was transferred to Dornbecker's intensive care unit. As you can imagine, I was very distraught and not able to work for a few days. I notified my field supervisor, Bill Labbert, and told him what had happened. He was very sympathetic and visited my daughter at the hospital. He suggested I tell the company owner, John Smith, about the incident. When I discussed my family crisis with Mr. Smith, he agreed to allow me a few days off without pay, but reminded me I need to continue to service my route. I felt a lot of pressure to choose between going to work or being with my daughter. I tried to work as much as I could, but my numbers suffered due to the amount of stress I was dealing with. On one occasion, when my daughter was in intensive care, Mr. Smith and Mr. Lambert told me I needed to get my paperwork in from the previous day's sales and suggested I locate a fax machine at the hospital. I constantly felt pressure to go to work even though my daughter needed me. My daughter was eventually transferred to a ward in Dornbecker's. My supervisor, Bill Lambert, continued to visit us at the hospital. He told me that he couldn't believe how well I was holding up and that he was disappointed that Z Medical was putting so much pressure on me. Sometime around the first part of January, I updated Mr. Smith about my daughter's condition. He told me he felt far from me but reminded me of my obligations to the company. I talked this over with Bill. He told me to tell the company I'm back. I did that. I did what Bill advised me to do, but also disclosed to Mr. Smith that my daughter was facing a series of surgeries and I may need to take additional days off in the future. Around the beginning of February, my numbers started to pick up and I again was one of the top producers. Everything seemed fine until I informed Z Medical that my daughter was scheduled for surgery on Monday, February 8th. I would need the day off. Mr. Smith reluctantly approved the day off. On Thursday, February 4th, I took a sick day because I had a migraine headache due to the stress, all the stress I was dealing with. On Friday, February 5th, I went to work and called to John Smith's office. He presented me with a handwritten letter warning me that my continued absence wouldn't be tolerated and that I needed to improve my attendance. Later that morning, I received a call from the hospital and advising me that my daughter was having brain surgeries and that they needed to do an emergency MRI. Her doctor requested that I be there. I left work early and drove to Salem. On Monday, February 8th, my daughter had her surgery. I was with her that day, assuming it was okay with Z-Medical, as I had already given them advance notice. I went to work on Tuesday morning, February 9th, and was immediately called into John Smith's office. At that time, he informed me that I wasn't submitting my paperwork in a timely fashion and that my attendance had been poor. He informed me that my employment with Z Medical was terminated. I was escorted from the property and told that I could not return. During my tenure with Z Medical, I was never disciplined for my attendance prior to my daughter's final episode. In fact, on several occasions, I was praised for my sales accomplishments. The medical knew my daughter would be hospitalized for 6 to 9 months and that I would occasionally have to miss work to be with her. The medical simply wasn't willing to allow me the time off I needed after the second suicide attempt. They were only concerned with my attendance and sales numbers. As I was happy with my job and planned to work for them a long time, I tried to tell them I would get through this, but they wouldn't listen. The firing obviously came at a very bad time due to the increased financial burden associated with my daughter's suicide attempts for injuries and the mental health care. I was off another job with a different company in the same field but was forced to resign by Z Medical due to a no-compete clause in the contract I had signed when I was hired by the company. They threatened a lawsuit if I continued to work for the new company. To this date, I'm still not working. My husband is a Portland police officer and makes a good income, but not enough with all the bills piled up from these events. Furthermore, we lost everything in a house fire a year ago last Christmas, which also caused financial burden. Z Medical was also aware of the fire and knew I needed to work. Their action was a grave injustice to me and my family. Currently, I have no recourse but to accept that injustice and try to find a new line of work. No employee in Oregon should be faced to choose between their job and their family. Had OFLA applied to me, I would have been eligible for 12 weeks of unpaid leave from November 11th to February 10th, so I would still have my job. Had I been eligible for OFLA leave, I would have been entitled to my old job back in territory. I understand the legislature is considering a change in law to lose the job protecting the workers' effort. Hopefully, currently employees have the right to be restored to their original position after open leave. The proposed change would allow employers to offer employees an equivalent position for commissioned salesperson. This would be a disaster. Had I received a new territory, I would have been forced to start from scratch, which would mean a drastic loss of income. I urge you not to weaken the current law. If you make any changes, expand the law so no family has to go through the hell we have endured. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. Steve Lannan and Jenny Bird Rimble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 125,000 working Oregonians. The Oregon AFL-CIO opposes Council 86. We were involved, we had a staff member 4 years ago that was involved in the original negotiations up until a couple of weeks before the end of the session when she herself took family leave to give birth to the child. I had a contact with her and I discussed some of the same things that you've already heard about. It turns out that the coalition that was involved, the family leave advocates, gave up quite a lot for job protection. And as far as our office goes, we felt that job protection was very important. And an equivalent position is not the same as the same position. It's just not, for a lot of the reasons that you've already heard about. This bill seriously undermines the agreement, the delicate agreement that was reached 4 years ago. And we urge you to oppose it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeannie Bergerfel. I'm with the Service Employees of the National Union, and to know that my council is able to meet with you today, and so I'm going to refer to him.
Chair, members of the committee, Tim Nesbitt for the Oregon State Council of SEIU. We appear in opposition to House Bill 2486 and in support of current law. Current law has been fashioned to balance job protection for workers returning from family leave with job protection for those workers who remain in their jobs. The way it does this is to provide the first return rights in one's old position. Currently, there's in effect a one-to-one relationship between the employee on family leave and the job that remains behind, the job that the employee used to hold. Under House Bill 2486, we're going to create a one-to-many relationship between the employee on leave and the jobs that remain in the workforce. By allowing employers to bypass return to one's old position when returning that employee from family leave, House Bill 2486 will expose all workers in equivalent positions to being bumped to accommodate a returning co-worker. In that way, House Bill 2486 will be more disruptive in the workplace. By allowing employers to place returning workers in any equivalent job, even a currently occupied job, it will expose all workers in such jobs to being bumped by co-workers returning from family leave. We think that the current law works best to protect the rights of employees on leave and to minimize disruption in the existing workforce. Further, by diminishing rights of return for employees on family leave, we're concerned that we will in effect discourage the use of family leave in those situations where employees have the option to request it or not. So we object to House Bill 2486 and urge you to vote no on this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. That's it. You want a few minutes of rebuttal? It's up to you. Okay. Just wanted to give you an opportunity. Any comments or questions from you? Committee will close public hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 2486. I guess this is the proper time for comments or questions.
Yes. I don't understand why I guess the bill is here in the proposal. I find it interesting that there's an article I don't remember the time, but it was the summer of 96. The Golden Business Magazine had, on their own initiative, had gone out and did a survey of the businesses to see how long it would last in here. It was interesting, too, that there were stories at that time that indicated that there wasn't any problem. There was no Golden Business Magazine. There wasn't a particular problem in this area that was worth as well. I've had to deal with this as an employer myself, implementing it, although technically in my business, I do not have to because you're smaller than 25 employees. It's just something that you sometimes have to do. It's not easy, but that's part, I think, of being an employer. I think the law that we have is a good law, and I think most employers are coping with it well. It's inconvenient, but they're coping with it. Unfortunately, there's always a few bad apples out there that are causing some problems that we've heard, and I think with a lot of our laws, you sort of have to have that protection in place where people need it. You're in an unempowered position, and I believe that we just have to keep with this law. And also, I would say that my experience is that you usually can work things out with your employees. If you've been a good employee, a good employer, and you've got a valued employee, you usually can work those things out if you need to move somebody around or something like that. Perhaps it's technically illegal, but I know people do that every day, and it usually works if you've been working in a positive manner with your employees and building a good workforce. Particularly in the scarce labor market we've got now, there's nothing more important than someone who does a good job for you and someone you've invested in. And I think this law speaks well to the kind of family values that we've had in Oregon, and there was a good compromise in 1995, and I think it's still a good compromise today.
Thank you. I appreciate what my good friend has just said, and I as an employer, have to deal with this, as a small employer, have to deal with this on a regular basis. And I believe that employers are able to work with the situation. I believe that that giving the employee the right of family leave and the guarantee of return to a life position is a good trade-off. And so I support the bill as it is. I believe that it is important, and as has been stated, a valued employee is an absolute positive to any burden. And so as an employer, I believe that the being bad apple can occur on both sides of this equation, that the family leave can certainly be abused, and that to consider that it might not be abused is stretching the matter beyond belief. So I think that it is a good balance to guarantee return to an equivalent job, and so would support moving the bill.
Comment, Senator Metzger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good law that we currently have, and I think it does address a lot of the concerns, and I applaud the legislature in 95 and the proponents and the opponents at that time in putting together what is now the family leave law. And it's interesting in hearing the discussion on this proposed amendment to that law, that neither the proponents or the opponents have demonstrated that there has been a strong need to make any changes in it. There hasn't been a lot of comment on specific problems that have been resulted from this law for those proposing the changes. The opponents of this 2486 and supporters of the current family leave law have clearly demonstrated why the leave law is important. And have not had a lot of difficulties there. But I think it is really critical to understand that it has been pointed out in this hearing that this is a good balance. The law does work well the way it is. And what happens is when you upset that balance is when things go away. And part of the thing I think about having some institutional knowledge, which I don't have and have to rely on my colleagues and others to talk about, these issues that were dealt with prior to my being here, to understand why those compromises are so hard to reach and why taking them one way or another is going to create problems for us. I noticed the letter from the governor provided us, of course, we're strongly opposed to making a change in that balance. His comment that the law is reasonable in scope, it's fair, and it's balanced. And I think it's important to maintain that balance for both employers and for employees. If, in fact, we have made the decision that family leave is important, and if, in fact, employees have, on occasion, as Mr. Harmon has pointed out and others, needed to take that family leave, if we do anything that would inhibit their willingness because of their career to afford themselves of what has been an important part of maintaining, you know, family life, then all of a sudden the family leave itself doesn't have the same merit that it did before. It is a delicate balance. I don't think we should upset that balance. It seems to be working exceptionally well. I think we go down a deep cavern to try to change that, and I think we should leave it the way it is and not make any changes.
Okay. Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Hi, everyone.
Well, I would just say that the preceding three speakers captured all my thoughts, so I won't extend too far, but I think this unfortunately shows you the complexity of certain situations that really are not indicative of the majority of situations in this state. This is a small business state. Most employers and employees have the ability to communicate and to do just fine without the help aid and assistance of a lot of these things that we impose on them. And sometimes I think that it creates more of a burden than a help. What I am impressed with is what Senator Metzger alluded to, a letter from the governor who is most frequently elusive. But in this case, I don't harbor much doubt. Of course, he doesn't use the word. It is the likely result of the passage of this bill, and that would be a lot of things. I would like to see, probably before acting, a letter from the governor that suggests what changes would be satisfactory to his office. Because as a practical matter, Mr. Chairman, even if we thought this was an appropriate public policy, a veto would not be overridden. And I'm not sure what the reason for the exercise is. I think we've identified him as not friendly to business, and he would identify us in some other terms. And that's fine. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm not sure we need to go through all the heartache. With respect to the uncertainty of the definition of the equivalent, I'm underwhelmed with a letter and the analysis by Susan DeGroff, the labor lawyer, and frankly, there is a reasonable amount of certainty that lawyers would always argue over what is substantially similar in terms of the five categories you sort of indicated in the proposal. That is not that difficult. So lawyers will always, you know, insert themselves and make it look impossible for opposing. So this is the usual response from the community. But, that having been said, Mr. Chairman, I think it might behoove us to await further indications from the Chief Executive before we head on over the plane.
Makes
some sense to me. I'm also sort of surprised that the Bureau of Labor, which is responsible for the ministry, and this is Jack Roberts, who is the chief negotiator of this in 95, isn't here to testify on this. I sort of wonder if what the Bureau of Labor's position is on the issue and what the commissioner himself thinks about it, since he negotiated the policy in 95. That might be worth asking you. I'm not sure how much haste there is in this. I wonder if there might be some value, since I suspect that this could not get through the governor's desk. I'm thinking about asking a survey, having voters do a survey over the interim and taking a beat and look at this and see how much of a problem that people really have with this. And frankly, I'm so surprised I heard Betsy's comments. I've heard that before, and I appreciate that. I don't mean to demean those in any way, but you're sort of torn between that and other ones that have been done about what is the issue here. Is there really a problem, or is a solution in search of a problem?
It appears that the committee would like some more information, so welcome to the work session. And we're enough for the bell coming for us. On that bell, if we update you to get some more information or answer some of the concerns that were expressed, I would certainly appreciate that. That we would call the meeting adjourned.